like Jesus, I've only ridden a horse once in my life. Have you noticed in the Gospels how he's always walking everywhere, and this is the only recorded instance where he gets on a four-legged beast? In fact, it's not the people of Jerusalem who are being enthusiastic about his arrival, but his fellow pilgrims who've been coming on that journey from the north into Jerusalem for the Feast of the Passover. So there's that heightened sense of expectation amongst his fellow pilgrims, who have, of course, seen that remarkable healing of the blind beggar at Jericho. They are impressed. And so in that heightened sense of expectation, they have made this enthusiastic and exuberant reception for him. You know, unusual things can happen on pilgrimages in a rather unexpected way. I remember one of the people I was trained with at theological college, a few years after his ordination. I got very upset over the ordination of women in the Church of England and affected to become a Roman Catholic, and was duly ordained as a Roman Catholic priest. And he decided to accompany some pilgrims on a pilgrimage to the shrine of Our Lady at Medjugorje in the then Yugoslavia. This will be money for jam, he thought. Take a few services, be seen in a highly visible way, talk to a few pilgrims. So he got on the plane, settled in contentedly to a seat, and ordered a gin and tonic, and thought and looked forward to the relaxed arrival in Yugoslavia. The flight attendant came up to him and said, "Father, please come to the front of the plane to lead us in the rosary, and we expect you to say that and lead us all the way throughout the flight, which will last about just over 2 hours." Why do this rather remarkable thing of ripping down palm branches and strewing clothes in the way of his path? Well, this recalls a relatively recent incident in the history of the Holy Land that Jesus had grown up in. Just before Christmas, Jewish people celebrate the Feast of Hanukkah, which commemorates the triumphant arrival in Jerusalem of Judas Maccabee to liberate the city and to purify the temple and to return it to the worship of Yahweh alone. Alexander the Great, in his remarkable short career, had conquered virtually the known world and died very young, and left control of his empire amongst his generals, who kind of divided the empire up. And the Greeks in the Holy Land were on a civilizing mission, which impressed a lot of Jewish people. Suddenly, there was a gym to go to. Suddenly, there were hot baths regularly, libraries. There were also, they thought, a few sensible reforms to religion. We'll just put a few of our gods into the temple at Jerusalem and abolish those tedious dietary laws. Well, this provoked a very strong response, and the Maccabee family led the insurgency against it. And what happened was a bitter civil war, because many Jewish people had identified with the reforming Greek cultural mission. So when the Maccabee family led their army into Jerusalem and palm branches were ripped down and waved, there was a certain note of triumphalism, a kind of ha-ha, we won and you lost. And it would have been very bad news for the Jews who had chosen the wrong side of the civil war. What followed is a warning to all those who look for liberation and freedom from wars of national liberation. Because the Maccabee family made themselves into a perpetuating dynasty called the Hasmonean dynasty. They became drunk with power. In the end, one of them even made himself both king and high priest. And then the family fell out amongst themselves, and the Holy Land divided into a kind of land of competing warlords, like Afghanistan. That's why, in fact, some Jews welcomed the Romans in. They wanted a return of stability and law and order. And that's the situation into which Jesus grew up. So he would have been aware of the highly ambivalent kind of welcome he's now receiving. For those of us with long memories, who remember the bitter civil war that Algeria went through after the war, who remember how Frantz Fanon warned the Algerians about what might happen when they'd eventually evicted the French. And he wrote this. "When the French are gone and we have prevailed, the vital thing will be for us to behave better than those we have struggled against. If the spirit of the oppressor enters into us and we end up ruling in the same way they did, then we will have lost. This struggle requires of us moral regeneration. As Jesus looked out on the crowd of fellow pilgrims waving the palms, he must have thought, oh no, this is not what I wanted. Because the kind of liberation he comes to bring is not a political and military one. It's of a very different kind indeed. It's been said of our situation right now that because of the events of Holy Week, because of the death and resurrection of Jesus, it's as though we're in a parallel situation to when the Allies landed in Normandy successfully. Now the end of the war is inevitable. What is required is a massive mop-up operation, which requires of us great efforts of cooperation with God's mission. The end is not in doubt, but there is a prolonged struggle ahead of us. But we must hope that we will not be seen similar to those as the Allied armoured spearheads drove into Belgium and Germany. Ben Witherington has said of the kind of peace that Jesus comes to bring as he draws near to Jerusalem this: it is the nature of his messianic rule that's a rule of peace, gentleness, and universal tolerance. Christians, like their master, are called not only to be peacemakers, but also to be those who live in such a way that rest and restoration, what Jews call shalom, is brought to those around them. So we might like to reflect in this coming week on whether we are peacemakers in our situation. And I don't mean the Colt 45 variety of peacemaker. That will mean exploring the wonderful dimensions of shalom, God's peace, in such a way that our manner of life brings rest and regeneration to those around us. Perhaps what we might like to do in the days ahead of Holy Week is to look at the first, second, and third chapter of the Epistle to the Ephesians. Don't worry, it's not too long. And in that beginning bit of Ephesians, the writer talks about the way in which Jesus drew onto himself all the antagonisms and hatreds of the human race, as though it's a kind of wall, like the wall that now divides the Holy Land between Palestinians and Jews, into which all these sectarian hatreds have come, and Christ then smashes it down to open up a new way for the human race. And that's what we're called to be in the church, to be a place where differences are overcome, where we set aside differences of race, sect, family, culture, to be a reconciled and new humanity. You know, in the 10:30 service, my words of introduction from a letter to the Hebrews are rather like that. It goes like this. The peace, I mean. For Christ is our peace. In his flesh he has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall that is the hostility between us, that he might create in himself one new humanity in place of the two, thus making peace, and might reconcile both groups to God in one body through the cross, thus putting to death that hostility through it. Ephesians and Hebrews have the same message at this point. May we live in this way of peace ourselves. Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.